their organs, they get rid of their choirs. So you have a tiny little Reformed Baptist movement in this country of about 24 dead musicless churches.
Because if you have any wavering in your confidence about the integrity of your translation of the Bible, it'll suck the conviction right out of your heart.
And that leads to some very interesting, heretical, and very important conclusions.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church. I'm here in my home in North Garden, Virginia. It is Friday, January the 23rd of 2015. Hard to believe that 2015 is here. It's been a while since I've done one of these. I think it was early December, the last one that I did. But I thought I would make a stab at doing another Word Magazine. I had two people email me this week and ask me about the supposed discovery of a first century fragment of the Gospel of Mark. One was a member of my church and another is a friend who is outside of the area. And apparently both of them made reference to a Washington Post article that appeared on January the 20th, making reference to Professor Craig Evans of Acadia Divinity School in Canada, speaking about this fragment. And so I thought I would give a response to that today, and I sat down and wrote up, I guess, a little article that I'm going to post as a blog post. If I cover some of this material and you aren't clear about it, you can look at the blog post at jeffriddle.net and you can read some of this in written form. Hopefully that makes it clearer. I didn't really write it up like an academic article, so it's not, doesn't have complete citations, things like that, but it's more on a popular level. This article that showed up in the Washington Post, January 20 of 2015, makes reference to a papyrus fragment from the New Testament Gospel of Mark that apparently has been recently found in an Egyptian mummy mask. And so apparently the deal is there are mummy masks in Egypt, and people who were less wealthy would make these out of basically ancient paper mache. And they take these masks and apparently have a way to dissolve them and take the paper. Apparently they think that the content of the papyrus or paper-like product from which these masks are made is more valuable than the masks themselves. The Washington Post article actually cites an article that was on a website called Live Science, January the 18th of 2015, that makes reference to this. The Washington Post article includes a YouTube video of Dr. Craig Evans, and Evans is a very well-respected professor at, again, Acadia Divinity School in Canada, and the little short video clip, about 3 minutes long, is apparently taken from an apologetics conference that was held in Canada in July of 2014. The video here that I'm looking at looks like it was posted around that time. Actually, it says published July 24, 2014. So one thing to observe is that this article that just showed up in the January Washington Post and the January Life Science, this is not exactly a new story. The supposed discovery of the smart fragment is not a new story. In fact, it goes back even further, as I'll point out here in a few moments. But I thought it might be worthwhile just to start out with listening to this clip. It's about 3 minutes long, and I'm mainly just going to play it and listen to it. I might make some comments, but this is Professor Craig Evans describing this new find. So let's listen to it. And this, by the way, the clip is actually an excerpt that's put up apparently by a group called Apologetics Canada. So there's a little intro to it, and then it gets right into his comments. Here we go.
But here's the one that really intrigues me. P, I don't know what, because it hasn't received a number yet. Will it be P128, 129? I don't know. It'll be published later this year. And where did we find it? Well, we dug underneath somebody's face, and there it was. That's a mummy mask that you're looking at.
The video, if you look at it, and I'll have a link to this on the blog post that I do. It's got a picture of a mummy mask made out of papyrus. So he started off by saying that this papyrus has not yet been dated, and he said, would it be given the number P128 or P129? And I'll address this in a moment, but he's talking about the way that ancient New Testament papyri are numbered and categorized. As I'll discuss a little bit later, in the most recent edition of the Modern Critical Text, the Nessolon 28th edition, there are 127 papyri manuscripts that are cited, and so this would be one that would be maybe 128, 129, depending on whether there are any others ahead of it in the queue. Let's listen to a bit more of what he says.
Let me explain what's going on here. This is very exciting. Mummy masks, if you were the pharaoh, were made out of pure gold. If you were a wealthy person, it would be neatly carved and perhaps then covered with gold leaf and a few jewels. But if you weren't really wealthy, and if you were just, I'll say middle class, you could afford a sarcophagus for the body of your loved one, but the mummy mask that covered the face would be made out of papier-mâché. Did you know papier-mâché dates back that far? At least 3,000 years. Now, paper was expensive, as I already said. So you don't take brand new papyrus, no matter how much you love grandma, and make a paper mache mask out of brand new paper. You use used paper. And that's the best kind, if you're a scholar, because we want to find old paper with writing on it, not old blank paper. Paper that's been used, paper that's been written. And, of course, if you're a pagan and you have no respect for the Christians, then you use their writings as trash, and you make papier-mâché masks out of their stuff. And their stuff includes the Greek New Testament. And it was from one of these masks that we recovered a fragment of the Gospel of Mark that is dated to the 80s.
Okay, so he's first got the explanation, and, I mean, obviously there's some questions that could be raised. How do we know that, the origins of this mask, how do we know where this fragment came from? How do we know it actually came from an Orthodox Christian group? And also, more significantly, how do you know that you can date this fragment to the year 80? And we'll come back to that a little bit later as well.
We can have a first century fragment of Mark for the first time ever. The more we find, we keep inching our way. Just imagine Gary Habermas now. We keep inching our way toward ground zero, the autographs. This is really amazing.
So Evans is saying that he thinks this find is significant because it helps get us closer to the elusive original autographic texts of, say, the Gospel of Mark. But as I've discussed many times over on these podcasts and other places, is that really the proper goal? Certainly that goal is one that's been abandoned by contemporary academic New Testament text criticism. They're no longer attempting to find the original. They don't think that, that's possible, nor do they think it's fruitful, but there are still people like Dan Wallace and apparently Craig Evans who still talk about trying to find the autographic text of Scripture. Of course, I think a traditional text approach would say that the autograph is found in the providentially preserved copies that we have in the traditional text. But let's finish up the rest of this.
You knew that that was a possibility. There are hundreds of these low-end papier-mâché masks that have been painted. But the trick was to get the mask to dissolve so that we could pull apart the papyrus without losing the ink on the papyrus. That would defeat the whole purpose. And some genius came up with a solution that allows the glue to dissolve and the paper, the papyrus paper, to come loose into pieces that could then be picked out of this little bath, and the ink is still on the papyrus. It's still legible.
So here he's described the process by which they acquired this fragment. They took this mask, they put it in this bath of this liquid that has chemicals in it that the glue dissolves, and you're able to extract the pieces of papyrus. And when they did that, one of these at least is supposedly a fragment from the Gospel of Mark.
We've recovered 2nd century papyri. That's why I'm not certain of the numbering here, and a papyrus fragment of Mark dating to the 80s, and other Christian sermons and letters and other things, as well as lots of secular stuff, and so the work will continue. This is very exciting.
All right, so that's it. That's the clip. And like I said, it's kind of misleading because the Washington Post article, the Life Science article, talk about this like it's something that just recently happened. Again, Evans was talking about this in July, apparently, of 2014. This is not exactly news. It's not exactly new news, anyway. And as I alluded to earlier, anybody who's sort of been following events in text criticism is aware of the fact that Dan Wallace, who is an evangelical text critic who teaches at Dallas Theological Seminary, back in 2012, also made references to the discovery of what he believed is a 1st century Mark fragment. In fact, when he had a debate with, I'd rather refer to it as a joint appearance, because I don't think he and Bart Ehrman really have to debate, because they're basically in agreement with how to do text criticism. They are both eclectic text critics. But anyway, they had this debate, supposed debate, and in the debate, Wallace made reference to this supposed 1st century Mark fragment that had been discovered, and Ehrman wrote a blog post about it. I'll put a link to that. So this conversation has been going on for a couple of years now. So the Washington Post article, the Life Science article, is a little bit misleading. What's strange is sort of the cloak and daggerness of this. Why, and Ehrman points this out, if you found something, why not go ahead and publish it? Why not put pictures of it on the web? Why not let people see it? And Ehrman was promising back in 2012 that it was going to be published. Here's Evans saying in summer of 2014 that it was going to be published that year. Well, 2014 has come and gone. It's now 2015. So it'll be interesting to see if it actually gets published in 2015. I don't know much about Craig Evans. I've read some of his works. He sort of strikes me as being the type of person who runs into some of the same problems that Dan Wallace has. On one hand, he appears to be an evangelical, On the other hand, he embraced heavily the historical critical method. He's embraced modern text criticism, for example. And that leads to some, I think, some uneven outcomes in his scholarship. On one hand, I feel like, who am I to question his scholarship? He's obviously a top rank type scholar. But again, I find some of the things that I've read from him, not that I've read a lot, I find some unevenness in it. Let me give you an example. On one hand, I read a book last year called How God Became Man. It was a response to Bart Ehrman's books, very skeptical book about about Jesus and Jesus' claim to divinity and the early church's affirmations of the divinity of Jesus. And there were a group of evangelical scholars who wrote a book in response. This book, How God Became Jesus. Ehrman's book was How Jesus Became God. Anyway, Zondervan 2014, but Evans contributed a chapter to that in which he gives an excellent defense of the historicity of the burial of Jesus, that Jesus was, that we have every reason to believe the gospel accounts that Jesus, after his crucifixion, was buried in a tomb. And that was something that Bart Ehrman was skeptical about. He claimed that the Romans didn't bury people who were crucified, and Evans gives tremendous primary source material that actually absolutely blows Ehrman out of the water. So that's kind of things he does that are great. On the other hand, I was remembering a few years ago, I read an article that Evans contributed to a book that was titled Bart D. Ehrman and Daniel Wallace in Dialogue, The Reliability of the New Testament, published by Fortress Press in 2011. And that was actually about an earlier joint appearance that Wallace and Ehrman had in New Orleans. The 2012 one, I think, was in Chapel Hill, where Wallace made reference to the Mark fragment. But this was an earlier one, and it had a transcript of the dialogue the joint appearance between Wallace and Ehrman. But then there was also just a series of articles on text criticism. I think they had something like a symposium and had these presented. And Evans was one of the presenters and then has this chapter. But in this chapter, he offers a conjecture that Matthew 27, verses 51b through 53, which is the account of those who were raised from the dead at the crucifixion of Jesus, he conjectures that those verses are not authentic and that they should be removed from the New Testament, that they're not an original part of the Gospel of Matthew, even though there's absolutely no dispute about the transmission of those verses in the Gospel of Matthew. In other words, there are no copies of the Gospel of Matthew where those verses are missing, and yet Craig Evans conjectures that they're not authentic, that they're secondary, were not originally Matthean. So my point is, Evans seems to present, like a lot of evangelicals who embrace whole hog modern historical criticism, he comes out with some rather uneven conclusions. So enough of that aside, the claim that's put forward by Evans and apparently by Wallace and some others that are working with them on this yet unpublished fragment, the claim is that it dates, you heard Evans say this, that it dates to about the year 80 AD. In the article, the Washington Post article, they say 90 AD is the claim. Well, if that's true, if that were substantiated, what would be significant about the fact that a copy of Mark is found, or a fragment from Mark is found, that dates to 80 or 90 AD? What's significant about that? The significance would be that it would prove the early existence of the Gospel of Mark. It would prove that Mark was circulating among Christians by the late first century AD. And Again, that's important, I suppose, to establish the historicity of the early Christian movement, and you know that Mark wasn't written late. But and it's an important point, I guess. But my question would be, who really challenges that? If you read through the standard introductions to the New Testament, even those that are written by non-believers, and I think once again about Bart Ehrman, his brief introduction in the New Testament that's published by Oxford University Press, he grants that Mark was written in the mid-60s A.D. That's sort of the standard scholarly viewpoint, is that Mark was written in the mid-60s A.D. Most people hold to what's called the Markan priority. They believe Mark was the first gospel, and then that Matthew and Luke, the other synoptic gospels, made use of Mark as a source, along with Q, a saying source that's no longer extant. And so they date Mark as the earliest, mid-60s, and then they date Matthew and Luke maybe in late 60s or mid-70s. This is standard type approach to the dating of the Gospels. So if you prove this fragment comes from the year 80 or 90, yes, it shows that Mark was circulating in the early first century, but just about everybody already agrees with that. It would give, you know, the earliest witness to the Gospel of Mark, which is now held by another papyri, but I'm not sure what it would prove. Evans also makes the claim that we just heard, that this would get scholars back to the original autograph of Scripture, or at least to the Gospel of Mark. And again, I'm not really sure how finding this a fragment from Mark would do that. Of course, a lot of that depends on where is this passage? How long is it? Is it a verse, a half verse? Is it a couple of verses? How long, how extensive is the quotation? And neither Dan Wallace or Craig Evans or anyone else thus far has given us any of that kind of information. Well, with that introduction, I want to go on and I want to do a couple things. First, I want to offer some general background information to you on the New Testament papyri. What are the New Testament papyri? And then secondly, I want to clarify some confusion that I think exists about the significance of the papyri, including this newest find. And then thirdly, I want to offer some reasons why I think this find is probably not as significant as some might suppose. So those are my three objectives for the rest of our time. First, let's talk about some background on the papyri. The papyri would be the plural. Of course, the singular is papyrus. And what is papyrus, or what are papyri? The term papyrus refers to writing material that was made from the papyrus plant, which grows along the Nile River in Egypt. In ancient times, they would take this, beat it down, press it together, and it was used, much as we use paper, to write things upon. A New Testament papyrus, or the New Testament papyri, would refer to pieces of papyri on which the text of the New Testament was written. So copies of the New Testament were written on these papyri. And in fact, the earliest New Testament copies that we have, the earliest copies of the text of various New Testament books, are found written on papyri, on this material. The material itself dates a copy as being ancient. If we find a copy of some passage from the New Testament, it's written on papyri, we know that it's very ancient. In fact, we know it's probably going to be dated to the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, or 4th centuries. Why? Because from the 4th century until the 15th century, the New Testament began to be copied on vellum. on animal skins. And part of that has to do with the spread of Christianity, its acceptance within the empire, the growth of wealth and prestige of Christianity. Early on, they were writing down copies of the New Testament on papyri, which is very cheap. After the 4th century, the church, Christianity, has enough wealth, power, and privilege that they can begin to write down copies of the New Testament on vellum. And again, that lasts until the 15th century A.D. And what happens in the 15th century? You've got the invention of the printing press. And so from the 15th century forward up till present times, copies of the New Testament are printed on paper. So papyri would be very early, then vellum, then paper. And of course, right now, we're in the midst of another technological revolution, aren't we? As the New Testament is now being written in digital form. And we're not sure really right now how that's going to affect the transmission of the New Testament for a generation to come. Will people even be using paper 100 years from now? Will people think about paper in the way that we think about papyri is a question. I just read a couple weeks ago a very good book by a fellow named Robert Hull. It's called The Story of the New Testament Text. In that book, Hull says that the first New Testament papyrus was discovered in the year 1868. So it wasn't until the 19th century that scholars discovered a papyrus fragment that contained writings from the New Testament. By the way, that discovery was made by a man named Constantine von Tischendorf. And he's perhaps best known because he's the one who discovered and published Codex Sinaiticus, or Sinaiticus, as some people pronounce it. But anyways, 1868, the very first papyrus was discovered. Hull also notes that 4 more papyri were published before the year 1898. So apparently there were just 5 papyri that were known in the 19th century, from 1868 to 1898. Now, that's important. I want to pause here for a moment. That's important because it reminds us that the rise of the modern critical text that toppled and supplanted the traditional text, the Textus Receptus of the New Testament, that the rise of the modern critical text did not come as a result of the discovery of various ancient papyri. The rise of the modern critical text came because of the discovery and the publishing of what are called the uncials, the early manuscripts that were discovered, like Codex Vaticanus, like Codex Sinaiticus, that written on vellum in all capital letters. This is what influenced Karl Lachmann, who came up with the first critical Greek New Testament that departed from the Textus Receptus in 1831. This is what influenced Westcott and Hort, who came up with their Greek New Testament in 1881. Of course, they were very dependent upon Codex Sinaiticus, or Codex B, not Codex Sinaiticus, but Codex Vaticanus or Codex B. And so anyways, the modern critical text, the rise of the modern critical text did not come about as a result of papyri discoveries. That's an important point to make, and it's often one that people fail to make. I mean, even if you've been listening to many of these, you remember some of my reviews and interactions with James White. And James White, although he claims to be an expert in text criticism, has talked about how important the papyri were and how the papyri supported the modern critical text. But actually, that's just not true. The modern critical text did not rise because of the papyri. The major papyri finds were not in the 19th century, but the major papyri finds have been in the 20th century. Again, Hull points out that by the year 1930, there were 42 New Testament papyri that had been published and categorized. Eldon J. Epp, who is a mainstream text critic, who's considered one of the leading text critics of our generation, has written and called the years 1930 to 1980 the period of the papyri. Among the most notable finds that expanded the number of papyri that we know about came in the publishing of two collections. One was a collection of papyri that were acquired by some scholars in the early 1930s, and they were called the Chester Beatty Papyri. Among these was one that was given the name P46, and this is the oldest copy that we have of the Pauline epistles. P46 dates to about 200 AD. Hull's description notes that the beginning pages of P46 are missing. It starts with Romans, from Romans 5:17. Then, interestingly enough, it goes on to Hebrews. It includes, puts Hebrews between Romans and 1 Corinthians. It assumes that Hebrews is a Pauline epistle. Then it has 1 and 2 Corinthians. Then Ephesians, which is ahead of Galatians. Then Galatians, then Philippians, Colossians, and 1 Thessalonians. And then the final pages are missing, so it doesn't have from 2 Thessalonians and 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon. Those were probably there. I'm guessing it was probably just a collection of Paul's epistles. But again, the order is a little bit different. So the Chester Beatty Papyri of the 1930s was one very important find in the 20th century. The second key find was a collection of papyri that were called the Bodmer Papyri, and they were published in the early 1950s. Among these is one called P66, or Papyrus 66, which dates to about the year 200. And it is one of the oldest witnesses that we have to the Gospel of John. And it is the oldest manuscript of John that we have that does not include the Pericope Adulterae. Very interesting. Another of the Bodmer Papyri was one called P72, which dates to the 3rd century. This is the oldest witness that we have to 1st and 2nd Peter and to Jude. And also included in the Bodmer Papyri is one given the identification P75, which dates to about the year 200. This is the oldest witness that we have to the Gospel of Luke, and it's one of the oldest witnesses we have to John. It's Luke and John. This one, P75, was actually purchased by the Vatican in 2006, and it is said to have a lot of close relationship in text form to Codex Vaticanus. And so the Vatican now has Vaticanus, and it has P75. Notice how the numbering goes up. Like I said, there were only four papyri in the 19th century. By 1930, there were 42. And you'll notice the ones that were discovered in the 1930s have numbers that are in the 40s, and the ones discovered in the 50s have numbers in the 60s and 70s. And you can see how, as new finds were made and they were assigned numbers, the numbers increase. And by the way, the numbering system was introduced by an American-German scholar named Caspar René Gregory, who lived from 1846 to 1917. And when a discovery is made, the official body that approves the number given, the Gregory number, so-called, that's given to these documents, is the Institut für Neutestamentliche Textforschung, or the Institute for New Testament Textual Research in Munster, Germany. So how many papyri do we now have? We're through the 20th century, into the 21st century. How many papyri do we have? Nestle-Aland 28th edition of the Greek New Testament, which is the most recent edition of the modern critical text, which was published, I think, in 2012, and a revised second corrected printing was done in 2013. It has an appendix in the back, and it lists the papyri through P127. So papyrus 127. And when it lists them, it's very helpful. It lists a supposed date, it gives you the library location, and it gives you the content. What portion of the New Testament does this particular papyri hold? If you go back and look in the 27th edition, the previous edition of the Nestle-Aland, which came out in 1993, it listed through P98. So there were 29 papyri that were found and categorized between the 27th edition in 1993 and the 28th edition in 2013. If you go back to the 26th edition, which was done in 1979, it went through P92. So again, you can see that as time goes on, occasionally finds are made, and if this is proven to be a legitimate papyrus, indeed, there may be in the next modern critical edition, there may be a P128, a P129, etc. So that's just a little bit about the whole issue of the papyri. I might also add that if you look at the Nestle-Aland 28th edition and they give you the dates for the papyri, again, generally range from the 2nd century AD. There are some that are later. There's at least one from the 8th century AD that was written on papyri, which have been quite late for the papyri. Some of them contain only a single verse or a fragment of a verse, sometimes just a few words. Example of this would be P12 contains Hebrews 1:1. That's it. More commonly, they consist of several verses, a couple of verses. Example, this would be P98, which has Revelation 1, verses 13 through 20. A few of them, much more rarely, contain or preserve the text of an entire book. So P72, for example, has most of 1st and 2nd Peter and the book of Jude. That's very unusual. None of the papyri give us an entire New Testament or all four Gospels or all Paul's epistles. The best we have is probably like P72 that preserves a book or a couple of books. Again, most of them are a verse, a half verse, a few words, a couple of verses strung together. Often, even if it's a couple verses, they're not in continuity because it might be some verses that are on the front side and verses a little bit later down in the chapter that are on the written on the back side. So that's basically what the papyri are. If you've ever heard the term papyri thrown around, hopefully that is a helpful explanation for you. Secondly, I want to clarify some confusion that I think exists about the significance of the papyri. I already noted that we have to be clear that the modern critical Greek New Testament was not based upon, nor did it come about because of papyri discoveries. Sometimes I think people falsely believe, well, we had the Pericope Adulterae in our copies of the Gospel of John, but then we discovered these ancient papyri where that was omitted. No, again, the 19th century modern critical Bible, the Enlightenment-influenced Bible, came from scholars working with unsealed manuscripts, manuscripts that date at the earliest to the 4th century, like Codex Vaticanus, Codex Sinaiticus, or ones that date to the 5th century, like Codex Alexandrinus. So again, the modern critical Bible is not based on papyri discoveries. In fact, Eldon J. Epp, again, a mainstream New Testament critic, leading critic of our day, wrote an article in the Journal of Biblical Literature back in 1974 in which he famously called the 20th century a mere interlude in New Testament textual criticism because, he said, so little had been changed or developed since the 19th century. In other words, his point was all these papyri finds, although 1930 to 1980 was the period of the papyri, in the end, the discovery of the papyri had not really changed the scholarly viewpoint on what the New Testament contained. It didn't really change the modern critical Greek New Testament. And again, this is something that James White is apparently unaware of because he talked, oh, you got to have the papyri. No, the papyri did not really affect our understanding, our modern critical scholars' understanding or articulation of the modern critical text. More importantly, it is often falsely assumed that the papyri finds only reinforced the theory of Westcott and Hort and the modern critical text. In fact, the opposite is true. If Westcott and Hort had been right, one would have expected that all these papyri that were discovered in the 20th century, one would have expected that their texts, because they were earlier and closer to the originals, one would expect that their texts would reflect the so-called neutral text, or what is sometimes called the Alexandrian text, or the text of Codex Vaticanus in particular. Because Westcott and Hort's theory was that Vaticanus was the neutral text, it was the earliest, it was the most reliable, it was most like the original, and then that was perverted, and it, most importantly, it was perverted by the Byzantine text, which conflated and harmonized. And so if we could just get back earlier, we would find this pristine neutral text before it had been adulterated. Here's the problem. When scholars study the papyri that have been found in the 20th century, they find that the papyri reflect what is called a mixed text type. That is, it includes readings. The papyri include readings that would be categorized as Alexandrian, like Vaticanus. But it also includes readings that support what's called the Western text, the one that was used primarily in the West, in Rome, the one that's reflected in Codex Beza, in the Gospels. They find papyri that support those readings. It also supports what are called Caesarean readings. And this is the really shocking part for many modern scholars. The papyri also support Byzantine or traditional readings. The papyri manuscripts, the early manuscripts that we have, very often support the traditional text or Byzantine text readings. The book that you need to read here is one that was written by a fellow named Harry Sturz, S-T-U-R-Z, and the title of the book is The Byzantine Text Type and New Testament Textual Criticism. It was published by Thomas Nelson in 1984. This book includes an appendix in the back which lists 150 papyri passages, papyri readings that support the traditional text or the Byzantine text. At one point, Sturz in his book notes that Westcott and Hort's claim that the Byzantine text could not be found earlier than the 3rd or 4th century, quote, vanished into thin air in the presence of the papyri, end quote. That's from page 63. And by the way, Sturz is not someone who supported the traditional text. He was not someone who supported the views of Dean Bergen or Hills. In fact, he writes against them. He seems to be, having read the book, really doing his research to support what is called thoroughgoing eclecticism, the work of Kilpatrick and others who want to choose readings from Alexandrian, Western, Caesarean, Byzantine. But so he's not somebody who supports traditional texts, but just based on purely the evidence, he says it is illogical, irrational, and just plain wrong to deny that the Byzantine readings can be found in the papyri, and they are just as ancient as the readings which support those chosen by to represent the modern critical text. So the third thing I want to move on and talk about then is I want to offer some reasons why this supposed new finding of Mark is probably not as significant as some might suppose, or as Dan Wallace or Craig Evans have suggested. And so let me give some reasons why I don't think this is as important as it has been said or thought. First, we need to acknowledge that we don't know anything about this fragment yet. We don't know how long it is. We don't know if it includes a few words, a few verses, an entire book. That's extremely doubtful. Obviously, it's in this mask. It's probably just literally a scrap with a few lines on it. We also don't know which part of the Gospel of Mark it comes from. That'll be very interesting once hopefully it's published. Where's it from? What does it say? It's probably, again, only a verse or two at most. I was thinking about that. It would be great if it were a fragment from Mark 16:9-20 and proved the early existence of the so-called longer ending of Mark. I doubt that's the case, or we would have heard some reference to it, or Wallace would not have praised it. So first of all, this finding is doubtful because we know at this point so little about it. Secondly, we don't know whether or not it comes from an Orthodox source. If it only consists of a verse or two, or maybe even part of a single verse, how do we know for sure that it actually comes from canonical Mark? How do we know that it comes from the Orthodox Gospel of Mark? It could be a fragment from a Gnostic book that was simply quoting Mark. Maybe after the line where this verse appears, if we had the entire document before it was ripped apart, maybe right after that line, there was a line if we could imagine this Gnostic document that refuted the very thing that was quoted. So we know nothing about where this document comes from. We have no guarantee that it comes from an Orthodox source. The papyri are notorious in that we can't understand much about whether they're Orthodox or not, and also the papyri also don't always reflect what we could call canonical integrity. Let me give you an example of that. We have P72, and I mentioned it includes 1st and 2nd Peter and Jude, very important as witnesses, early witnesses to those books. However, P72, alongside 1st and 2nd Peter and Jude, it also includes a book called The Nativity of Mary. It includes the apocryphal correspondence of Paul and the Corinthians. It includes the 11th Ode of Solomon. It includes Melito, the church father's homily on the Passover. It includes a fragment of a hymn, a work called The Apology of Phileas, and renderings of two psalms, Psalm 33 and Psalm 34. So P72 doesn't reflect the work of a person or a community that understood the Orthodox canon of Scripture. And so the papyri are unsteady and uncertain in that regard, and from what we've found out so far, which is almost nothing, we have nothing so far to indicate for sure that this comes from an Orthodox source, and that should raise some questions in our mind before we're jumping up and down with glee about this proving the early date of Mark. Third, I might note, the dating of papyri is apparently notoriously difficult and can be subjective. I'm certainly not an expert in this. I've only read a few comments from people who are. And from what I've read, the dating of papyri is very hard to do. It's very speculative. And so we need to take claims of it being written, this fragment coming from 80 or 90 AD, very skeptically. For a long time, most scholars have argued that the oldest fragment of a New Testament text that we have is a papyrus that was called P52, the John Rylands fragment, it's sometimes referred to. And you can see by the numbering, P52, about, you know, when it was discovered, sometime between the Chester Beatty papyri and the Bodmer papyri. P52, about the size of a credit card, it has a fragment on one side, it has John 18, 31 through 33. On the other side, it's John 18, verses 37 through 38. And if you read many New Testament textbooks, Introduction to the New Testament, almost always they will say P52 is the oldest text that we have, copy that we have of a New Testament text. And it's important. Evangelicals really love P52 because they believe that it dates to about the year 125 AD. And this, this proves that John was written early rather than late. You may not know that there's a debate. Enlightenment-influenced modern critics have had a tendency to say John is late. The Christology is too developed. It can't be primitive Christology. And there was a tendency, particularly among some radical German scholars of the Enlightenment, to want a really late date of the Gospel of John. Then you find P52, and it dates very early. And so we know that John was circulating very early. So that's how the argument runs. However, in recent years, there have been some challenges to the early dating of P52. I recently read a 2005 article by a fellow named Brent Nonglobri. I'm not sure if I mispronounced his name. But he wrote an article, 2005, it was in the Harvard Theological Review, Volume 98, Issue 1, pages 23 through 48. The title of the article was "The Use and Abuse of P52. Papyrological Pitfalls in the Dating of the Fourth Gospel." And in that, he pointedly challenges the early dating of P52. And he would argue that there's really no way to know with certainty when P52 was written. And it's speculative to say it was written in 125 AD, so that it could have been written late 2nd or even the 3rd century. Along those lines, I recently read a post over on the Evangelical Text Criticism blog by another credentialed New Testament scholar named Dirk Jongkind. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that name correctly either. But he has suggested there, and I've got a link to it, I'll have a link to it in the blog article, that the oldest New Testament papyri that we now have may in fact be one that has the designation P104, which is a fragment from a couple of verses from Matthew 21. And interestingly, he points out coincidentally that 104 is twice 52. So P52 was thought to be the earliest. Now he and some others think that actually P104 is the earliest New Testament manuscript that we have. Regarding the dating of this supposed Mark fragment, I'm also going to put a post to another article on the Evangelical Text Criticism blog, this one by P.J. Williamson, another respected academic in the U.K., who's also an evangelical, in which he states that contrary to the claims of Evans and Dan Wallace, this fragment could not possibly be dated so precisely as to say it was written in 80 or written in 90. And it's very, also very interesting, if you read to the end of that article, he has some comments about the ethics of dissolving these mummy masks. He believes, implies that it's unethical to destroy the mummy mask to get to the papyri. Fourth reason to be skeptical and to challenge the importance of this find, and I think this is the most important one. This report, I think, illustrates the pitfalls of chasing manuscripts to attempt to prove the authenticity of the New Testament. You cannot prove or disprove the validity or the historicity of Scripture by amassing manuscripts in the end. I just don't think you can do it. The Lord did not allow the autographs to be preserved. We don't have the autographs. The Lord did not allow the autographs to be preserved. It obviously was not His will for the autographs to be preserved. So finding scraps of papyri will not, in the end, get us closer to the autographs. God has intentionally not allowed those to exist. Also, finding these scraps of papyri, I think, in the end, are really not of any apologetic value. They don't prove or disprove the antiquity of the Bible to a skeptic. They don't prove or disprove the authority of the Bible to a skeptic. Of note here, it's interesting to read the blog post that Bart Ehrman wrote when Dan Wallace floated out this idea, the mention of this first century mark, as if it were some kind of trump card to use against Ehrman. Ehrman noted in that blog article, which I'll also have a link to, that Dan Wallace spoke about this like it was the equivalent of the Dead Sea Scrolls discovery. And he wrote at the very end of the article, he said, he is wrong about that, quote, in fact, if it is just a scrap as it appears to be, then it probably will not change a single solitary thing in the entire field of New Testament textual criticism, end quote. And I think here I have to agree with Ehrman, although I passionately would disagree with him on doctrine, on theology. I think he's right about this. I think this find in the end will not really have a big impact on New Testament textual criticism or on apologetics. Confessional Christianity teaches that God has providentially preserved His Word in the faithful copies that were made and used by God's people, and that were made and have been used by God's people in all ages. This is what is reflected in the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Savoy Declaration, the London Baptist Confession of Faith, Article 1. That's not to say there isn't a place for scholarly study and the collection of papyri. There is a place for that. That's important work that needs to be done. I'm not saying ignore that. But let's not make overstatements or false claims about such finds with regard to early dating or other things. Let's not claim more than we can actually establish. And in the end, we know we have the Word of God, not because of we find papyri witnesses, but we know we have the Word of God because of the text's own self-authenticating power. And that's expressed in the copies that we have, in the faithful traditional text. All we have to do is read the Word of God and we see its power. It's not proven or propped up by finding scraps of papyri. So anyways, I hope these comments will help enlighten some things about papyri in general and about this finding of supposed finding of a fragment from the Gospel of Mark as well. Well, again, I hope you've enjoyed this issue of Word Magazine. I will put this article up on the blog. If you'd like to read it in more detail, jacob.net. And take care, and God bless.
Your deeds, Lord, make me glad. I'll joy in what you've done. I'll praise your doings, Lord, how deep your thoughts each one. Fools won't be shown. The foolish can't accept this truth to him unknown. Those sinners grow.
Just grows like cedars fall.